college. I don't have really any examples of my own because we're not doing this well in mainstream news. Mm. And then that's going to set you up, and I'm going to be like, and that's why we invited Rico Moore, because he actually is doing a really great job on this. And then if you I included just one slide of welcoming relatives home, the Bighorn one.
Okay.
Towards the bottom, so that's where you talk.
Okay.
And you just kind of tell us about how you go about your reporting and how you get outlets to take stories like this and give us advice on pitching our own. And then Glenn had a few stories he wanted to talk about.
Totally. I think I was thinking about this too. And it's like, you know, maybe people just need to start their own publications. You know, maybe we don't need to worry so much about editors who have limited vision.
I'm having a hard time hearing you. Oh, maybe it's because he's doing a little audio stuff over there. Mm. Were you turning me down or Rico up? I couldn't hear him. By the way, we're over the speakers right now in the whole room.
Yeah.
Okay. And then after I after I do the slideshow, I'll flip you around so you can see the audience.
Thanks, Steve.
Cool. Okay. Yeah, it's a little challenging for me to hear him because I'm behind it, but I guess that's okay.
Check, 1, 2. Should I just, like, sing or something?
I think he's got you sounding good. It was just a little, like, high and abrasive. Cause it's
tinny. Oh, me?
Yeah.
It's just my voice.
No, it's because it's tinny, because it's on the computer.
So then I can really, like, I can really say something.
Yeah, you gotta talk like this.
No, I gotta talk like this.
Also, there's been an issue here. The rooms are right next to each other, and the sound quality... The sound has been bleeding into each other's rooms because the, like, sound, the quality of the walls isn't, like, oh, a kitty. Good morning, kitty. Who is that kitty?
Fennel.
Who is that?
It's my cat. It's my cat.
What's their name?
My cat. Fennel.
Oh, Phil?
Fennel.
Fennel. That's a
cute. Like the spice.
Are you at home in Seattle area, then? You're not in Colorado right now?
No.
So wait, what time is it is? What time is it is for you?
Hey, what's up, Eric? It's about 5:57 a.m.
Oh my goodness, Rico got up. Got up at 5 in the morning for this.
It's all right. I appreciate it.
Well, some folks are trickling in, but it's a little early.
Can they hear me? Do you think?
Yeah, I can hear you, but he turned me down. So.
Okay.
Yeah, we're gonna give it a few minutes. Everybody was out last night. It was the beat dinner night, so it might be a little slow start.
Everybody was out getting COVID.
I'm not sure if he can hear me very well right now. Because... Okay. Can you hear me all right now, Rico?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay.
We're making this as complicated as possible. Rico couldn't make it, so we're putting him on Zoom. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Testing. 1, 2, 3. That's kind of loud. We don't want it to bleed into the other room too much. Yeah, experiment with those backgrounds, Rico. That one's cool. Oh, I like that one for planetary boundaries. It's perfect. Yeah, that's going to be way too loud.
I'm in space.
I just want to be... I've been at this exact same spot the whole time. Where would you like me? What would be the ideal spot? Right here?
It's fine. I mean, it's where it is, actually.
Okay. I just don't want it to be too loud for the room next to us. Yeah. Right here. Very great.
Boom. Yeah. No. God, if I haven't been caught...
There's about six folks in here right now, Rico.
How are you this morning?
There's about six folks here right now, slowly trickling in.
Nice.
I don't want to flip the computer yet because there's all these cords hanging out of it, so I think I'll just have to just describe it to you for now.
You know...
Sounds good.
Glenn, would you mind scooting over a little bit? I got my back.
Sure.
Yeah, he's
remote. He's remote.
You can say hi to him. He can't see you, though. I'm sorry, what's your name? I'll tell him that you're here.
So are we sharing this one, or how are we doing that?
Eric Hoffner's here, and he's excited to see you, Rico.
Hey, Eric. Cool. Thanks for stuff.
So...
Nice to meet you in person. Yes. Oh, I think they were just...
So if you need anything from
not
me,
really. They're not.
Are you
going to
be standing the whole time?
No, I can sit back down and share with
Glenn.
Okay, but why don't you guys test your mics out?
Testing.
Testing. Testing. Sounds good.
All right, looking good. Rico, people are trickling in. We'll start pretty soon.
This is good. We've got the old tech and the new tech. The old ways and the new.
So, when Rico wants to speak, can he just, like, unmute himself and start talking?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, hear him right now.
Can you hear me? Check, check, 1, 2.
Yeah,
yeah,
you can just talk.
You.
So I'll just set him up like we discussed, and then I have the slide of one of his stories, and he'll talk about his stories.
Okay. In the third section? I mean, of course he can give feedback.
Where is the pause?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
You just tell us when I get to talk.
Need any more?
Then I'll set up Rico for when he gets to talk.
Okay.
A hair closer. Like that?
Like that, yeah.
Okay. And is that good? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'll probably be sitting like that, about like that. Yeah, okay.
Okay, I trust you. I got this.
Howdy. More? More howdies? Yeah, I think it's working.
Let's remember to say our pronouns too, because they're not on the slide.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone. We've got a really technically complicated panel, so took us a minute to set up, but I'm feeling good about it. Rico Moore is on the screen. He can't see you right now. He can only see me, but I'm going to flip him around so he can see you in a little bit. And we'll get started, yeah, whenever Erica's feeling ready. She's the moderator, but I'm up here because I'm doing computer stuff. Yeah, like this.
Hey. I'll just give it a couple more minutes and let a few more people come in from breakfast.
It's exciting that there are this many people here who want to talk about this with us. Was everyone out late last night? Is that why they're trickling in slow? Which beet dinners did you go to? We went to the, I was at the Global Water one, the Ag and Water Desk one. Did you guys go to any beet dinners?
Methane.
How was the water one?
It was a vegan forward meal, which was nice. And it was about global water issues. So it was like really big picture. A professor giving us a slideshow. Getting really nitty gritty.
Uh-huh.
It was great. Just like keep the conference going until like 9:10 p.m.
Who is the professor?
Something Moore, not Rob Moore. I can't remember his first name. Penn professor.
Okay.
Water stuff. Rico, just so you know, we can hear you moving stuff around pretty loudly here, so just be aware of that.
Oh, thank you. Sorry about that.
No need to be sorry, but just so you know, if you're, like, moving things around.
Thanks for the heads up.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
They're all saying good morning.
All right, do you want to, shall we start?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming to our mega session. We're planning this to be very interactive, so we've broken it down into three basic sections. And in each section, we're going to have a period of about 20 minutes where we want to discuss your stories as they relate to the subjects that we're talking about. So, you know, they could be stories you've already written where you want to share something you learned. It could be something you're in the middle of writing or that you are hoping to write. And we will discuss, you know, challenges in terms of getting editors to accept such stories. We have two editors on the panel, and we have two freelancers. Myself and Rico are freelancers, and Glenn and Tegan are editors. So we have that diversity of perspectives to offer. And so we're really hoping that you guys will make this very lively and dynamic, and that we'll be able to explore a lot of these ideas. So this panel came together because four different people, the three of us and one other, Rico, came along later, had proposed panels for this conference that were related. And so we kind of mashed them together. And they're all kind of based on tackling cultural assumptions that a lot of our journalism and that our societal narratives generally are based in. Things like technology is good, that the economy should grow forever, that humans are most important, and that mainstream society has the most worthwhile answers. So in this panel, we're going to introduce you or discuss in more depth, if you already know about them, three key areas of complexity and some examples of stories that did them justice, and then brainstorming, you know, how to pitch, report, and write these stories. And, you know, a lot of these might be considered fringe ideas, but they are all growing movements, and so we feel that they're important to cover. So just briefly, so you can be thinking, the first section is going to be about, like, single-focus problem-solving techno-optimism, which is sort of where we are generally in society. And then the alternatives are systems theory, nine planetary boundaries or overshoot. The second section will be capitalist economics and the myth of eternal growth, and maybe a bit about pronatalism. And then the alternatives are donut economics, ecological economics, environmental economics, circular economy, steady state economics, all these kind of alternative economic models. And then the third section is going to be our assumptions of human exceptionalism or even supremacy and how that plays out in various, in basically everything we do, but also in the legal system. And then alternatives would be traditional ecological knowledge, indigenous worldviews, deep ecology, and rights of nature. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the first one. We're going to also have a bathroom break at some point because it's 2 hours and 15 minutes, and we all just had our coffee. and that'll be about a five-minute break, so really quick. So, yeah, it's like 6 a.m. for Rico, I think. He's on the West Coast. So.
Yes. So I guess I should allow us to introduce ourselves briefly. My name is Erica Guise. I should have said that at the beginning. I am an independent journalist and the author of Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge.
And I'm Glenn Scherer. I'm at Munga Bay. I'm the global editor at large, which means the planet is my beat, which is quite a beat, a big beat.
I'm Tegan Wendland. I'm the editor for the Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk, which is a collaborative journalism project based at the University of Missouri. I live in New Orleans, though. And Rico, you can go next.
Hey, I'm Rico Moore. I'm a freelance journalist based in Port Townsend, Washington. I'm also on the board of directors for SEJ.
And Rico's adorable tabby cat might make an appearance as well.
Could you guys hear him all right, by the way? Okay, great.
All right, so I'm going to introduce our first topic. Thank you, Tegan. So our culture's tendency towards single-focused problem-solving extends to journalism coverage of climate change. And, you know, I've been covering climate for 20-plus years from the days when we were, lots of people were, you know, doing the both sidesism. We were denying that climate change was happening. Then, well, it's happening, but humans aren't causing it. And now that it's kind of been more broadly accepted, it's really been oversimplified into, like, we need to get off fossil fuels, which is very important, but we could get off fossil fuels tomorrow and it still wouldn't halt climate change because of the really significant land use changes and the way in which we have dramatically altered the water cycle. And, you know, water vapor is also a climate, a greenhouse gas, and, you know, water vapor is the primary way that the planet cools itself. So in reporting my book, Water Always Wins, I really started grappling with the water piece of the story that I felt was being overlooked. So, you know, we hear a lot about how climate is causing bigger floods and droughts and more frequent floods and droughts. And, you know, we often hear our infrastructure wasn't built for these extremes. But in fact, water and biology are also affecting climate. And that's a critical fact that's ignored in a lot of policy discussions. And we often respond to floods and droughts with the single source problem solving. You know, they're more control, higher levees, bigger drains, longer aqueducts. But our infrastructure is, in fact, part of the problem, a big part of the problem. Urban sprawl, industrial agriculture and forestry, and concrete infrastructure used to control water. Could I have the next slide, Tegan? So the scale at which we've altered the water cycle globally is really extreme. We've filled or drained as much as 87% of the world's wetlands, dammed and diverted two-thirds of the world's large rivers, and the area covered by pavement in our cities has doubled just since 1992. Deforestation is decreasing rainfall locally, regionally, and globally, and drier areas such as the U.S. West have been dramatically desiccated by killing beavers, levying rivers, overgrazing, overpumping. So, you know, we got here because of that single focus problem solving. You know, worried about flooding, build a levee, build a wall. Worried about water scarcity, build a dam, bring it in from somewhere else. But putting ourselves first in that way is failing increasingly often because it ignores water's agency and relationships with soil and rock and microbes and beavers and plants and people. And therefore undermines them. And so the people that I met in my book all around the world, the water detectives, these are engineers, ecologists, landscape architects, urban planners, farmers, ranchers, foresters, they're asking a different question. They're asking, what does water want? Next slide, please. And, you know, in our dominant culture, or in the dominant culture, we tend to presume that, you know, with that single focus lens, water is either a commodity if it's scarce, or a threat if there's too much. So the people in my book are all part of what I call the slow water movement, with kind of invoking the slow food movement. And basically what water wants is a return of its slow phases that are particularly prone to our disruption. So these are wetlands, floodplains, mountain meadows, and forests. And slow water projects use systems thinking rather than single focus problem solving, thinking about how all the elements work together. They are distributed across the landscape rather than centralized, ideally local, helping to understand the water, local water cycle and availability and work within it. They are environmentally just. So I think we're familiar with the idea that levees, you know, block off part of the floodplain, so they raise the river level, and that increases flood risk on other communities who maybe can't afford a levee. But dams are also an environmental justice issue. Over a 40-year period, they brought water to 20% of the world's population, but decreased water availability to 24% of the world's population. And slow water projects typically engage the community in care for the water, communal care for the water, sometimes just with an educational component, but sometimes like with a very hands-on component. So just quickly, a couple of examples from my reporting. Next slide, please. So, you know, in the West, there's this narrative that water is scarce, that we don't have enough. Streams often run only in the wet season, but in fact, historically, a lot of streams did run year-round because they were supplied with a healthy groundwater table from below. And California biologist Brock Dolman calls the last 500 years the age of drainage. So all these ways that we've dried out the land, by levying off rivers for their floodplains, channelizing and straightening rivers, killing beavers, draining wetlands, cutting forests. So I did a story for Popular Science about natural infrastructure for dryland streams, which are all of these interventions that you can see on this graphic. And landowners, Valerie Clark and Josiah Austin, moved to Arizona, southern Arizona, in the 1980s. They bought a cattle ranch there, and they found that previous settlers had been really hard on the land. They had cut the trees. They had really hard grazed it for cattle. And so when the monsoon rains came, they would just rush away within, like, a couple of hours. And there was a lot of erosion. And so they kind of instinctively built, like, a little rock dam across their stream. And they were inadvertently copying a technique that indigenous people in the area had been using for thousands of years in the Southwest and in Mexico. Next slide, please. So this is what their stream looked like after just a couple of monsoons. It runs year-round. There are wetlands all along the riparian area. And, you know, downstream, landowners were suspicious, like, they're holding on to our water. But a scientist at USGS, Laura Norman, studied this work extensively, and she found that they actually made the stream produce 28% more water. Because in the degraded stream, she did a paired stream study, you know, the water was just evaporating, right, running over hard rock and evaporating, whereas this is infiltrating that slow water, moving the water down into the ground. So by taking care of the stream and its systems, that systems thinking, you know, it's instead of the scarcity mindset, it's actually abundance. Like, the stream is actually producing more water. Next slide, please. So industrial forestry is another major way that we've disrupted the water cycle globally. Cross-disciplinary scientists are discovering connections among plant water and climate. So climate is affecting water, yes, but water and biology are also affecting climate. And healthy life systems with a balanced water cycle can buffer not just water extremes, but also keep the climate stable. So scientists have found that evapotranspiration from soil and plants provides, on average, 40% of rain over continents. So if you've cut those forests, you lose that rain. They also help create rain because their rough surfaces slow the wind and they release particles that all help the rain to form. And their exhalations also feed into jet streams, which creates rain on the other side of the planet, or conversely, drought with deforestation. And, you know, people used to think that temperature differences between ocean and land is what pulled in the rain, but atmospheric physicist Anastasia Makariva has shown that forests actively pull in the wind to deliver the rain that they need. Next slide, please. And there's a lot of talk now of, like, planting trees for carbon storage. Like, if you hear about nature-based solutions, that's often what it is, right? Like, let's store carbon and plant some trees. But almost all these projects do not consider the water cycle. And so that, again, we have that single focus even in the solution. Like, let's store as much carbon as quickly as possible. Like, let's plant a plantation of pines because they grow really fast and they'll store more carbon.
Well, and also looking at the trees as, like, a way to do a thing for us.
Yes, very much, yeah. So anyway, researchers have found, like, it's better to spend money protecting an area, providing alternative livelihoods for people, and letting the trees kind of replant themselves. And restoration done well can improve rivers and underground water flows for long distances. And I was reporting in Kenya for my book, and people there, that was just, like, kind of common knowledge because they had seen deforestation, you know, dry out their springs, and they had seen reforestation and better land use practices for agriculture restore their streams. Next slide, please. So last thing I'll talk about is just the frequency and severity of fires is also increasing with climate change, but there's a water cause here as well. Industrial logging is making fires worse because of the way it interferes with the water cycle, and that's something that fire reduction policies largely ignore. So a study of 1,500 fires in the western U.S. forests over 30 years found that protected forests, in fact, had a lower fire severity than areas with more logging. And yet, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, cleaning up forests. So why is that? It's because industrial logging clear cuts old trees that transpire the most water. They reduce rain. They heat the climate. And that removes understory plants and decomposing wood that creates this kind of spongy, moist environment and severs trees from the mycorrhizal network that shares, you know, all the systems, all the ways in which it's breaking down the systems that make the forest really healthy and strong, kills organic matter in the soil, and soil with organic matter can hold orders of magnitude more water, making that available to the plants. Next slide, please. So, you know, climate change is very overwhelming, and I think a lot of us, a lot of people in the world are expecting centralized solutions, you know, people, international governments making agreements. But the slow water projects are decentralized. They're something that people come together with other people in their own communities to buffer themselves from flood and drought, and there's also a climate reduction impact. And I'll just give a tiny little tease for our upcoming section on economics, which are also prone to that single focus, right? If you're looking at building a levee, the cost-benefit analysis is like, is this levee going to protect this community? It's not looking at, is this levee going to increase flood risk for this other community? Is it going to damage this ecosystem that absorbs floods, that, you know, supplies food for the fish, et cetera? And so, you know, many of these slow water projects do have multiple benefits which aren't counted: protecting against flood and drought, storing carbon, supporting other species that keep systems functioning, and, you know, a more healthy, stimulating habitat for us. So, yeah, more stories about that in my book, Water Always Wins. And now we are going to talk briefly, before we talk about your ideas for the stories in this area. Glenn is doing a section at Manga Bay on the 9 planetary boundaries, which is one alternative system to the single focus. And so take it away, Glenn.
Yeah. So how many of you have ever seen that wheel before? One. Okay, that's really cool. So planetary boundaries. What Erica just talked about, really complex, right? A lot of moving parts. Well, that's just one of the 9 planetary boundaries. Give a little background on this framework, planetary boundaries framework. What happened, before 2009, the paper came out in 2009, group of international scientists all over the planet, led by Johan Rockström. That's a name to remember. He is an Earth system scientist who's been trying to organized the world scientists to really look at the environmental crisis systematically, to say, what are we doing wrong, and what are the systems, what are the Earth systems threatened? And they came up with 9 systems. I mean, this is a bit arbitrary because, you know, the Earth is holistic and we're not so holistic. They came up with these 9 boundaries, and they're called boundaries because it's like guardrails along a highway. You don't want to pass through the guardrails. So they tried to come up with these 9 systems that are threatened, operating systems that are existential threats to the planet. Everybody knows climate change. Well, that's just one of the 9. So the really scary part of this that, and I started on this 3 years ago, working on a planetary boundaries series. We've done 180 stories for Manga Bay already on planetary boundaries. Really a wealth of knowledge in there. I recommend you Google Manga Bay and planetary boundaries, and you'll see the whole series. Go back to the beginning, and you can follow foundation stories on all the 9 boundaries, follow all the way through. But the idea is, okay, water, critical to life. also critical to life, the carbon cycle, which, of course, you know a lot about because of climate change, but also the nitrogen and phosphorus cycle, which nobody, you don't hear a lot about, but we've got an awfully big dead zone down at the mouth of the Mississippi River because of nitrogen and phosphorus imbalances. What we're doing is unbalancing all these natural systems across the board. And I'm just going to quickly go through the nine systems that they're talking about. And some of them, the trouble with scientists is some of these don't have very sexy names, but they have really huge impacts. The first one, if we go clockwise, or actually going... I have trouble telling time. Is that clockwise? Okay, we're going to start with climate change. And then that one we know about. The next one they call novel entities. Really awful name, I thought, when I first heard it. Like, what's a novel entity? Anything we've introduced to the environment that wasn't there before. And that's hundreds of thousands of synthetic chemicals, all kinds of, you know, radiation, nanoparticles, anything we've...
Plastics.
Yeah. And anything you can think of, anything in this room is probably a novel entity. It's synthetic. And what they try to do with each of these boundaries is come up with a metric. For climate change, we have the 1.5 degrees. Really, that's the guardrail. We don't want to go past that. Novel entities, when they looked at it, they had to decide, are we in the red? The red, it means we've overstepped, we've overshot these boundaries by their assessment. They decided we overshot novel entities because the world scientists and policymakers can't evaluate new chemicals and new synthetics fast enough to know what the danger is. So we are flying totally blind with novel entities. Next one, stratospheric ozone depletion. We know a lot about that because of the Montreal Protocol, and that's because of our global treaty and because corporations actually cooperated and really worked to reduce the ozone levels, find replacements for all the ozone-depleting chemicals being used in refrigerants and stuff. That's one of the boundaries we've actually done better on, so we're not in the red zone there. I'm going to just continue through these because I could take all day on each one of these because they're such big topics. Atmospheric aerosols, that's any kind of particulate and microplastics, which are now pole to pole everywhere. The soot we saw last summer all over the world. I mean, soot is a naturally occurring thing in the atmosphere. There are fires. There are wildfires. Always have been, but not at this scale. And they are so they're changing things, especially regionally and locally, like we saw Canada, the U.S. with the fires last year. Ocean acidification, that's another product of climate change. But again, it's a basic system, changing the pH in the ocean. And that has huge effects on phytoplankton, and then on up the food chain, on zooplankton, and then on small fish and big fish, all the way up the food chain. The biogeochemical flows, I mentioned that already. That's nitrogen and phosphorus. That was actually the first boundary we violated, and agriculture is such a critically important factor in what we need to do to get these boundaries back out of the red. One of the things Rockstrom said in a recent talk is what we need to do is develop a global sustainability transformation. He said that is vital to the world, to completely rebuild our agriculture, because we've got to, the biogeochemical flows are so severe. With the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus, we have just totally unbalanced that cycle way more than the carbon cycle, even more than the water cycle. So serious problem, and I'm going to keep moving through them because, again, I could go on about these. Freshwater change, Erica really handled that well. I won't say more about that. Land system change, deforestation, infrastructure, fragmentation with roads, and all the things we do to change natural systems on the land, changing forests into plantations, that all those sorts of things. And again, all interrelated to the ninth boundary, which is biosphere integrity, which you also mentioned. All of these, the really big thing is to understand all of these, imagine them as standing dominoes. And you destabilize climate or you destabilize land systems and they start to wobble. And then they hit the next boundary and the next boundary and the next boundary. And you start to destabilize across all these boundaries. You can see it on very local levels in your communities. You can see it regionally. You can see it globally. And one of the things I do now as a reporter, anytime I'm looking at a new story, the first thing I do, the best tool I have for planetary boundaries is a Post-it note. I have online boundaries, and I have it next to my computer, and I just, whatever the problem is, whatever the issue is, whatever the solution I'm looking for, how connect the dots. You know, you look at and start to see tipping points in your community. Okay, so you're going to build a new municipal center, let's say. How is that building, which you're going to plop down, if you cut down the forest that's there, that changes cooling in the community because trees provide cooling, for one thing. They retain water. So as soon as you plop that new building down, you're affecting the water. You're affecting the land system change. You're, in a small way, affecting climate. You're going to have all kinds of synthetics introduced in that building. How are those being disposed of? Any waste? That kind of thing. So I go through the nine boundaries, and I start to frame my story around that, and I have an organizational system, which is what this is. It's a way of measuring the health of the planet in nine different systems and saying health of the system, of the planet, regions, biomes, communities. So even though Rockstrom isn't proposing this on a local level, you can use it that way to frame your stories, and it's a really valuable tool. The other thing that's part of this is overshoot, which is also was in our blurb. Not going to talk a lot about that, but again, that's the idea of the guardrails, because if you burst through that guardrail, now you're out of control. You've overshot. You may hit a tipping point. And what a tipping point is essentially, if you can picture a bowl, right? And there's a marble, and you drop the marble in the bowl, and you start to move the bowl, and the walls of the bowl will keep that marble in there. And that's what our climate's been for like 9,000 years. That's what our water systems have been. That's what our land systems have been. Everything stayed kind of, there's been a lot of shifts. We've had cold periods, warm periods, but that marble has stayed in the bowl. But if you tip that bowl too much, out the marble goes and it goes into another bowl and everything changes. You've changed the paradigm. You've changed the earth system. And that system might not be so friendly, probably very likely won't be so friendly to life because life is adapted to the bowl that we were in, not the bowl we're getting rolled into. Okay. So we want to avoid that as much as possible, getting that stability back. Really important to see those interactions I was talking about. Rockstrom said, I interviewed him about a month ago. Very good interview on Munga Bay. You can look it up. Talked to him for like 35, 40 minutes. He said what they're studying now is the interactions between the nine planetary boundaries. And that's really important. What they're hoping to do is develop an early warning system where scientists all over the globe are interconnected. They're working on looking at the nine boundaries. And it's so important that if you're going to look at a solution, let's say you're going to look at a solution for climate change. And I'm going to offer, I'm almost finished up here, but I'm going to offer an important example. There's a lot of examples of this. We are so tunnel focused on climate change right now that some of the solutions we're doing are actually far more destructive than the problem. So one of the solutions they've come up with, and it's in the EU, the US is supporting it. It's being supported all over the world. Japan is supporting it, is biomass. Biomass burning for energy. How many of you are familiar with that? Okay. Biomass burning for energy. So, and as soon as you think about it, it's like, how stupid is that? We're going to cut down forests, make them into pellets, which takes a tremendous amount of energy. Then we're going to ship them across the ocean to the EU. The forests are generally in the southeast U.S. Now we've got the carbon releases from the shipping. Then we're going to burn them in power plants, old coal-burning power plants, and put it into the atmosphere. But because of a loophole in the Paris Agreement, and trees are renewable, right? So we don't count that carbon release. Now, obviously, that is a bad solution. That's a solution that doesn't look at the 9 planetary boundaries. So any solution, Rockstrom says, you gotta look at how it's gonna affect all the Earth systems. You can't just look at one narrow focus.
We've gotta wrap it up.
One more boundary, and this is just came out last year, is justice. We've got to look at how to correct these systems, how to fix them. By the way, you can see there how originally they only had 3 boundaries in 2009 violated. Then it went up in 2015. 2023, they're now saying 6 of the boundaries, the metrics for 6 boundaries. We are really in the red zone. So the last one is this idea of justice. How do you begin to work on these problems and achieve equity and justice and fairness for everyone, for, you know, not just the elites in the North, but the global South, for indigenous people, traditional people, and allow them to contribute to the solution. Okay. So that, in a nutshell, is 3 years of the work I've been doing. And I invite you all to send me pitches because I need stories.
Thank you, Glenn. Tegan, are you able to put Rico on the screen?
Yeah, can Rico and I each take our turns, or where are we at?
I was going to have the some dialogue with the audience first.
Okay.
But you guys, if you have stories that are related to this topic, feel free to offer them, either you or Rico.
I just have a sort of journalism talk in general that I was going to do, so if you want to do audience stuff right now for a bit. I think that makes sense if people want
okay.
to ask questions.
So we'd invite you to share your stories that you're working on at this point in terms of this first section. The other sections are going to have much shorter introductions, so we'll have longer to discuss, and if we don't have time for everybody's story in this section, we can discuss those in future ones. So would anybody like to offer something that they're working on or thinking about or have worked on?
Somehow I got put in charge of tech.
We need to use this if Rico can hear us. So.
Okay. Hi, I'm Herb Simmons. I'm not a reporter. I'm an author. Among other things, I've written a book called A Climate Vocabulary, The Future. And almost all of the issues that you touch on are reflected somewhere in my book and somewhere in my research. So this is about the most exciting way I can imagine to wake up on a Saturday morning listening to you all. I've got at least 2 terms that I've heard you say that I will add to the next edition, slow water and carbon sticks. So thank you for that. So one of the things I found came across when I wrote my book and did the research is something that at least I found, and here feedback from others, seems to be missing in both the climate science and in the climate reporting, and it's, you know, maybe a little obscure. It's what I've dubbed the climate microbiome, and that is the large-scale impact at every level of microbes, invisible, and how they affect every one of those systems that you described there. And if I could just read three sentences here at the beginning there. There was a warning from scientists in 2019 that put humanity on notice that the impact of climate change will depend heavily on responses of microorganisms, which are essential for achieving an environmentally sustainable future. The statement, quote, put humanity on notice that the microscopic majority can no longer be the unseen elephant in the room. It's a bit of a mix of metaphors that I'm quoting. If microorganisms aren't considered effectively, it means models cannot be generated, predictions can be inaccurate, says Professor X, one of the 30 signers of the warning. So anyway, just throw that out as something that I would love to see both the scientists spend more time on in an interdisciplinary way and the reporting community.
Thank you. Tegan, yeah. I wonder if in your reporting on the ag desk, since microbes can be very important in ag, have you seen any, have you done any of those kinds of stories?
Not really. You know, and that's what I'm going to talk about when it's my chance, like how hard it is to do stories about these types of things in traditional media. I work with 10 largely traditional media outlets, a mix of nonprofit and public radio and newspapers in the Mississippi River Basin from the headwaters to the Delta. So Star Tribune, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a lot of more traditional daily papers. And I come from more of a daily background in public radio. And yeah, it's hard to figure out how to do stories like that.
So what do you think is the, like why are the decision makers in your organization resistant to?
I'm the decision maker. I'm the editor. But okay. I have to produce content that is publishable at all of these outlets within our collaboration. So I have to think of what, you know, those daily news editors would actually want to publish in their newspaper.
So you feel like it's just too fringe and they will reject it? Or like, what's your thinking when you're...
Yeah, I was going to go into this a little bit in my talk, but like what is news, right? Like we've been taught it involves a lot of people. It's holding the powerful accountable. It's happening right now. And just the way that we determine what news is and how we've been taught to do that traditionally in journalism school and in our experiences in daily news outlets, I think makes it hard to elevate stories like this that require nuance and explanation.
Okay. Sharon?
This is interactive. I didn't expect this.
So I'm Sharon Guinup, freelance writer. For me, I don't see this so much as a story as a lens to filter the way we're thinking about stories. And additionally, you know, what I see missing from so many stories I see these days, often because of, you know, really tight length requirements, is the important context. And for me, like, I often may use some aspect of, you know, this kind of framing as the kind of context that I feel the public needs to really understand the importance of whatever threat, issue, whatever I'm covering. So, again, I mean, it's just a little bit of a shift. For me, I don't think of it as a story, but I think of it as a framework.
You know, here's an idea. As you look at these and use that as a lens, that chart, that wheel, if you use that as a lens and a way of thinking about these problems and talking about the microbiome, how do you get people interested in phytoplankton? So we did a story, really extensive story on phytoplankton because it's not only being affected by climate change, which scientists already knew for like the last 20 years that the numbers are dropping. Well, phytoplankton is eating microplastics, and we don't know exactly how it's affecting them, but it isn't good. And phytoplankton's vital to the health of the planet, but it's also vital to fishermen. Because if you don't have phytoplankton, you don't have zooplankton, and you don't have the little fish, you don't have the big fish. So if you're in a coastal community and you're writing about the fishing, you know, commercial fisheries, now you've got a story about phytoplankton. So, you know, you've got to bring it home to people. And all of these stories can be brought home. They all affect us. You know, it was like talking about war yesterday in the really wonderful workshop about war and the environment. Everybody was hyper-focused on Ukraine and the Middle East right now. But every single factory all over the United States that's making weapons, that's, you know, bring it home. Bring it back to where you're reporting from and start to see how these big picture ideas fit in to your either small town or regional reporting or U.S. reporting, whatever you're doing.
Hey, I don't mean to interject. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, I was just going to try to get
I was going to say, Erica, I was confused. I thought we were going to all have a chance to speak.
We're doing the three chunks, and so you're introducing the third chunk. But you should feel free to comment on the first chunk if you have a story that's related, or if you want to talk about the single focus or the nine planetary boundaries.
Just in maybe to formally enact my solution relative to this, I'm just going to start talking a bit about... I'm going to introduce some things that I think are important to kind of introduce at this point relative to what's been said already, just from a basic sort of standpoint to kind of sort of see the conversation. And the first one I would say, and I can't see, but I'm looking at the doorway there, which is interesting, but how many people in the audience think that water is alive, is sentient?
Raise your hand and I'll tell him. One, two, three, four.
Okay, and how many people think the Earth is sentient and alive?
15, 10.
Okay, cool. So that's just curious. Okay, so I'm just going to read a quote from a scholar that I had on a panel last year in Boise named Carmen Gonzalez. And it's from, she does some research on racial capitalism. And I think that racism is key to this. White supremacy culture is key to this discussion. So she writes that the planet's wealthiest inhabitants, the global north, plunder nature and exploit vast swaths of the world's population through colonialism, genocide, slavery, race discrimination, the unpaid domestic labor of women, and the post-colonial domination and immiseration of the states and peoples of the global south. And so in the field of environmental journalism, I think the story yet to be told enough in its echoes and iterations is that the challenge that we face is how to interrogate and criticize the system that provides for each of us to do this work, to live our lives. And I think that a lot of times we talk about technological solutions, these sorts of things, and it seems to me that climate change is a manifestation of a process that started a long time ago, and it's an ideological process. So when did it start? What are the origins of this ideology, this unsustainable ideology? And I think we each kind of have to start by asking ourselves these questions. When did our ancestors lose their connection to the earth, the water, and its ability to support our lives? When did that happen? How did it happen? Because I think it's only by investigating these origins, these ideological origins, into the form of these unsustainable ideologies that we can really get at sustainable origins. We can start noticing them in the world around us to report on, whether we amplify stories about indigenous communities, you know, restoring wildlife populations, restoring ecosystems, restoring water systems, etc. Because there are lots of communities that are doing this work, so how do we do that? How do we perhaps center those more so than we center technological innovations, which, to Glenn's good point, are often just as destructive? So I would want to put those out there just briefly for people to kind of think about in these conversations. So yeah. I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Rico. Yeah, there's a big section in my book about that, like how do we get to this cultural point that we are now, and yeah, colonialism and the role that plays, and like the othering of people, but also the othering of the environment, right? When you have people who are new to a place and it's not their place and they're maybe afraid of it and they have a different relationship, this control. So, I think that's really important. So I'd like to talk now about our second tranche, which is about alternative economic theories. And Tegan is going to introduce this as well as, what brought her to this topic in the first place.
Yeah, and I'm sorry about this awkward setup. We really wanted Rico here, and unfortunately he couldn't be in person. So we've come up with this workaround, but it's a little wonky and has me running around a bit. So I'm definitely not an expert at alternative economics, but it's something I've been thinking about a lot, and I kind of wanted to speak from a journalist perspective. We started getting into that a little. But in preparing for this, I was reading a 2016 Guardian article saying, and kind of making the argument that the climate movement has made a huge mistake. They've really focused on the attention on fossil fuels, like Erica said.
Go what's the matter? A little closer to the mic.
A little closer. We're bleeding into the room next door, so I'm also trying to be cognizant
of
the
audio
issues. That the climate movement's made a huge mistake by focusing on fossil fuels instead of pointing to the basic logic of dominant economics, which demand extraction because of the focus on constant growth and politicians saying we have to grow our economy 3% each year. And, you know, that's impossible. And no wonder we're seeing ecological collapse. And what is our role as journalists in perpetuating and validating these dominant paradigms through the way that we tell stories and determine what news is? By economic standards, disasters are actually profitable because of the economics of rebuilding, because it generates business. And how does that make any sense? You know, what kind of system are we participating in, and what are our values if disasters are seen as a net positive? So this is something I think about a lot, but I haven't felt like I've had the freedom to kind of explore different methods of storytelling, and so I was really interested in being part of a group here and exploring that together and maybe getting some ideas for how I could do this as an editor who's working with these 10 newsrooms. So like I said earlier, I have 10 newsrooms from the headwaters to the Delta, where I live in Mississippi, or in New Orleans on the Mississippi, and I've been there for about a decade and reported on coastal land loss for the NPR station there before I took this job. And we're about to add a bunch more partners, a lot of them in the South, and most of them newspapers and a couple of public and commercial TV stations that we'll be working with. And then we share all of that content for free through a distribution system. It's kind of like a free AP Wire type thing, and it's all environmental stories. So I'm in a position where I could do this kind of stuff, but I'm trying to figure out how, right? So, yeah, it's a perennial sort of problem on my mind, and I just feel like so many story pitches involve the value of ecosystems and economic systems or population centers, like the value of the port, the value of New Orleans, the need to protect humans and properties. And it makes sense that we frame stories this way because the government measures value this way, like the Army Corps cost-benefit analysis is based on economics, Erica mentioned earlier. I grew up on a farm in rural Wisconsin where my mom has really progressively embraced more indigenous practices in her relationship with the land, permacultural practices that encourage interspecies support, and bringing back pre-colonial crops in cooperation with some local tribes. We're white German descendants, but my mom's like a radical who's into this kind of stuff. As I've grown into environmental reporting, I've read more and more about traditional ecological knowledge as well, which has really changed how I think about myself in nature, which has been interesting, like realizing that when I was out hiking, I was like thinking of myself like I'm Tegan hiking in nature, and now I'm thinking about myself as a little bit more part of the ecosystem, like my compostable self in relationship with the species around me. And, you know, as always, Western media kind of starts taking theories like tech more seriously once some white dudes publish papers on it, like wildfire management, for example. It's a great example that Rico's reported on a bit in the West. there's a burgeoning field of research around alternative economic systems that we're going to talk about some more. So really questioning the idea of constant consumption and the GDP, such as Kate Ratcliffe's Donut Economics. I'll pull a slide up in a sec about that, which proposes an economic system that measures its success based on the well-being of all species rather than constant growth. And I think we often just get stuck in this cycle of upholding dominant paradigms without questioning them. Like Bhutan's, if you've heard of this, Bhutan has a gross national happiness index. And it's kind of treated as like absurd or fringe. But like, why is that? And what is our duty as journalists to elevate and explore these ways of thinking? Isn't it our duty to encourage people to consider creative solutions, especially at this moment? And it's happening in a lot of outlets, but less so in mainstream media. So how can we convince editors that stories about animals, stones, or rivers are worth telling, even if there's no economic value in the lead? Like, what would those stories look like? I was talking with one of my journalists who asked me a really interesting question this week about what does the Mississippi River want, right? I'm based in New Orleans and have been reporting on coastal land loss for a decade, and you know, we've got all these levees and so much engineering. The river has been engineered to, you know, dump out into the Gulf of Mexico, where we're losing all this sediment that could be rebuilding the marshes that have been eroding there for decades, 100 years, maybe more, since the oil companies started building on the coast. And instead of letting the river do what it wants to do, which would be going through the Atchafalaya River, a river that a tributary that hits it north of Baton Rouge, we are going to build these giant diversions south of the city of New Orleans to save the city of New Orleans. Billions of dollars spent on opening up the river to rebuild the marshes there by channeling that sediment, ecosystem services, to rebuild that land. What if someone told the story from the perspective of the river? Like, what does the Mississippi River want? It wants to go out the Atchafalaya and abandon New Orleans, and New Orleans would have no water and no port, and some communities would also be lost that are in that path. But I haven't seen any story from that frame. Like, would a newspaper publish that? I think that would be such an interesting way to report that story. But instead, we're, you know, most of the stories are about, like, how do we get the diversions approved, and how much money are they going to be, and the Army Corps scoping process, and, you know, it's like assumed that this is the route we have to take. And so I would just love to see more journalism that questions those dominant paradigms. And, you know, when I tried to think of examples to show you of my own stories, either stories I've done or stories I've edited, I really came up short, because most traditional media is not doing a good job at this. We're really confined by the constraints of daily and traditional news. And what I mentioned earlier, like what we're taught about what news is, you know, holding powerful accountable, money, timeliness, number of people impacted. And I think some outlets are doing this. Munga Bay, Yes, Hakai are doing awesome work. I'd just love to think more about how to get stories like these in more mainstream and even small daily newspapers like the ones that I work with. And so much of this comes down to who we see as legitimate sources. You know, when my radical homestead prepper mom started talking about rights of nature 10 years ago, like, I kind of thought she was a little crazy. Now we're all talking about rights of nature, right? Because I've been steeped in academia and daily news culture that has taught me to uphold systems of capitalism and Western academia. And so I'm not here because I've figured this out or have any solutions in particular for you, but because I wanted to be part of an open conversation with other journalists, acknowledging our role in upholding extractive systems and talk about different ways of telling stories. And that's also why I invited Rico to be on this panel, because I think he's doing that really well already. And I have a slide of one of his Yes stories. I'd love for him to talk about it at some point or now, if that works.
Yeah, our third section is going to be really focused on traditional ecological knowledge and alternative worldviews. So I guess it kind of depends on whether the story fits in that or the economic, and also the rights of nature will be in the third section.
Well, shall we give him a chance to respond? Because maybe he'd like to talk a little bit about some of the things I just said as well.
Sure, yeah. And just like, what does water want? Is a central question of my book. So, like, that's a narrative that I've been trying to push in the reporting that I've been doing.
Yeah, so that's perfect. Can you do that? Can you do the story? What does the Mississippi River want?
Yeah, possibly. So why don't we have Rico talk a little bit about alternative economic theories that he may have reported on?
Well, his series that I really wanted to focus was this text series on bringing relatives home.
Okay, that we'll talk about in the third section. So just a little bit about, Tegan mentioned donut economics. There are a lot of other alternative economic theories, like ecological economics, environmental economics, steady state economics. Somebody asked Michael Regan about that, I believe, yesterday, or maybe it was the other panel. And these can be considered super fringe to a world in which we are, really indoctrinated into global crony capitalism. And I was writing a story recently for Nature about the circular economy, which has become kind of co-opted as a buzzword and greenwashed. But ultimately it means, waste from one process serving another, or, true sustainability, right? And global crony capitalism isn't about everyone having enough. It's about making the very rich even richer and exploiting something to sort of ecological or economic extinction. So when I was writing about this in this Nature article, the editor, I interviewed Robert Costanza, who kind of tried to put a value on nature. He was one of the early ones. He's at the London School of Economics. Gretchen Daly, the Natural Capital Project at Stanford, redefining progress, these alternative progress indicators besides the GDP, which address what Tegan was saying about, an accident is, or a wildfire is good for the economy because, then the emergency responders kick in, et cetera. So there are these other things like Bhutan's National Happiness Index, but there are many that people have been pushing. And so this editor was like, this is super hippie fringe. You can't have this in here. And when I pointed out to him that, the Natural Capital Project at Stanford has been there for 25 years, London School of Economics has a major program, that kind of legitimacy sold him. And, to his credit, he was open to it. He was open to me educating him about that. And ultimately, it did end up in my story. But that's sort of the dynamic that, is pushing against.
But it's almost the same thing of waiting until Kate Ratcliffe at the London School of Economics writes a book about this, then we can start using it and reporting on it because the London School of Economics is taking this seriously.
Yes, definitely. And in the third section, we'll talk a lot about TEK and, the kind of marginalizing of that has happened for a long time and how that's changing. But you're right, it's the factor here as well. I think we could take 10 minutes to talk about your ideas in alternative economics, take a really quick break, and then come back for the rights of nature and TEK.
Okay, Rico, I'm going to face you to the crowd, and then I'm going to go do my mic thing again. Just a second.
Thanks, Tegan. Thank you very much.
You can see, Rico.
Tegan is going to hand you the mic.
Yeah, I'm giving my exercise this morning.
Hey, thanks, guys, for doing this. One thing that I think...
Can you tell us your name?
Oh, yeah. Hey, sorry. I'm Ethan Friedman. I'm a freelance reporter. I think a lot of this, the alternative economic stuff is really interesting. One thing that I've been concerned about in terms of, my own hesitation in terms of taking on stories like this is that occasionally I've seen it sort of start to meld a little bit with, the overpopulation concerns that I think a lot of environmentalists have very rightfully moved away from in the past few decades because... as we know, it can very easily trend into some very, very disturbing right-wing politics. So I think when you're talking about reporting on these things and in terms of talking to different sources, learning about different theories, how are you sort of going about saying, okay, how do I feel about this? Is this something that I want to be bringing to the public attention? Is there a potential for some, dangerous elements to take up ideas here? Because, when there is that sort of potential, I think it's careful to be, or important to be cautious about these ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I've reported on population issues, and you're right, they're very third rail and very tricky. I think there are ways to write about that respectfully and accurately. You know, certainly pairing it with consumption as well. But I think, you know, there is, like the person who was first on this panel had included pronatalism as part of that. And I think that's part of that economic growth that you hear, like, you know, oh, Japan has, you know, declining population and who's going to take care of older people? And we hear it here too. Like, we need more people to fund Social Security and Social Security. You know, so it's very much like the economic eternal growth, you know, that, you know, there is a biological imperative to procreate. And so it's a very, very personal topic for people. So it's touchy in that way. But I think we do have cultural and economic and system biases toward the ongoing growth of population that I think is worthy of questioning.
Yeah, I'll say, just to respond a bit, I did a panel last year. Ethan, you might want to look it up. It's on, I think it was called Climate Change. It was about climate migration, the intersection of climate migration and white nationalism. And so I think this is a point that kind of comes up to me. It came up to me a lot as I was preparing for this panel, and that's the complexity of the problem that we're facing and how a lot of times journalism and editors want something that's reader-friendly, quote-unquote, or easily digestible. But I think, you know, we all kind of recognize that the paradigm needs to change, the ideological change. There's an unsustainable ideology, to coin a phrase, that we need to work to change. Trying to tell these stories that are intersectional, for example. I did a story a couple years ago about a liquefied natural gas export terminal that impacted the human rights of an indigenous community, a tribe, Native American tribe, migrants, who many of whom had fled because of climate-related reasons or climate-worsened factors in Central America, in a detention center in an industrialized area. So the intersection of these and how they express themselves in human rights. And so I think our challenge a lot of times is to be able to find editors with the, dare I say, the capacity to recognize complexity and field stories like that and communicate them and tell them. So I think that this population argument that gets made, you know, coming out of some of the stuff in the 60s and 70s, some of these books being very clearly anti-immigration and racist and certainly being taken up by the far right in political discourse, is very important to make sure that we tell about that too. I mean, you don't avoid something because it's sticky. You address it directly and you include a component of that in your story. That would be my advice there, is to not shy away from things because they're complex, but to wade into that complexity. Don't escape from that freedom, as Eric Frome would say, but engage with it directly, you know?
Yeah, and there's one other side to that complexity as well, which is, like, I'm a person who chose not to have children, and as a woman in dominant culture, like, that, it's becoming more acceptable, but it really, like, there is so much pressure to, you know, follow the path, and so I think that's another aspect, like, why in our society is it not okay to not have children, for example?
So have a dog instead of a child. Rico did a really good job in this nuance with this Yes series that we'll talk about in the text section. But I feel like, Rico, you really gave us a lot of context for the background of, like, where these tribes lived and why, and their relationship with the government and the history sort of the species that you're highlighting in that series. So I'm excited to have him talk some more about that.
There's something that I notice a lot when I'm listening to NPR. I'm sure it's true with other media, but I happen to notice it on radio, which is that you'll hear a story about climate change, and it'll raise some really interesting issues and concerns, And then the next thing that'll happen is they'll tell us with some positive news that the price of gas has gone down, or that the amount of air passengers is back to its pre-pandemic level. And we're supposed to be happy about both of these things. And it makes me think that, I mean, most people are not steeped in this. Oh, I don't think I said who I am. Dan Grossman. I report on climate change science. And I think that people who are not steeped in things like me are basically going to be completely confused by these messages. And they really have... you've completely diluted the first story by what you did next. And so there's, at the end of it, there's no sort of overall message that people can take away. It's like, well, on the one hand this, on the one hand that, you know, I have no idea what to think. But I'm happy that the price of gas is down. And, you know, I don't know what to do about that, and how, media organizations that aren't niche, like, let's say, Manga Bay, are going to have a policy, I mean, you know, a policy that's sort of like, we are no longer going to pretend that that we can keep on living our lives the way we always have, and that things are going to be okay. I don't think that NPR is going to do that. I mean, but I think they should. I think that we need to kind of find an answer to that, though.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, they're not making decisions based on the values, their stated values as a news organization, right? So they're not all talking to each other and figuring out what the message is that they're trying to relay, or really questioning dominant paradigms. I don't work for NPR, so I can't really speak to that, but I have noticed that myself.
I mean, yeah, I think part of it is that it's...
That's a really good point about the form itself of journalism. Right. So like when you're talking about form, the form, the frame, the form of the story, the form of a publication, the form of a news broadcast, Dan, that's an excellent point. I think that's absolutely accurate and true, and has a huge impact on the public mind and the public consciousness, and is in a real important way. So it's like, how are the forms we're telling reifying the power structures that are perpetuating this unsustainable ideologies? And I think, again, to go back to this point, and this is, I think, something, this is the reckoning that we're facing as an industry, and especially in the context of the environmental journalism field, is how do we interrogate and criticize the very system that provides for us as individuals to do this work?
And I'm sorry, Rico can't, like, see everybody in the room, so it's a little bit awkward. So Dan wanted to respond quickly.
Yeah, I think that, you know, to some extent, and I'm just going to, you know, I don't watch, the only electronic media I really watch is or pay attention to is NPR. So I'm sure it's the same in TV, though. It's all a bunch of, like, yummy bite-sized cookies that we take in. And it's like we go from one to one to one. And there doesn't have to be any relationship between them. We're therefore not giving people a something that they can really no overall analysis.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd agree with that too. I feel like so much of what's happening with climate change is it's like the latest sexy frame, and we're like moving climate change like a little Ouija board thing, you know, like over, oh, how is it affecting tourism? How is it affecting business? How is it affecting, like, we just use it as a frame instead of reporting on it more holistically.
Yeah. Can we stop for a minute, please? So we have 1 hour left. I'd like us to take a 5-minute break. And when we come back, Rico will introduce TEK, Rights of Nature, et cetera, and then we'll open it up. And if people have questions that were related to the other couple of sections, you know, feel free to pop in with that as well. So I just want to kind of make sure we have enough time for that. So it's 10:15. Let's be back here at 10:20, and we'll hear from Rico.
question. You mentioned, I'm familiar with Manga Bay, and yes, but what's the other?
Hakai.
What is it called?
Hakai, H-A-K-A-I. It's like an online news outlet.
And tell me about it. I'll look it
They're
up.
They're just very ecologically focused. Like a story I was thinking about sharing here today was called How to Love an Oyster. And it was all about this oyster in the...
It's an online kind of...
And it's just really lovely, in-depth treatment of environmental issues. Kind of similar to Yes.
Yeah.
I don't read it as much as I'd like, but it was like an example that came up in my research of like outlets that really were doing a good job at this. I'm glad you're enjoying it. It's a little wild with the Zoom and everything.
Well, I mean, you know, we've had a lot of these discussions about alternative economic systems. And
Nico's hanging with us, too.
And just, we need to be exploring these things more. So I bet, anyway, great.
Yeah, it's something I think about all the time, but I haven't had a chance to talk with a bunch of other journalists about it. So I'm just hoping I can come away with some ideas myself.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you. Hey.
I'm Kayla.
We met. Did we hang out last time a little bit? Or you were in our workshop, right?
Yeah. So it was great, So really also awesome that we get to kind of report on the whole watershed, But I just had kind of more specific question or something I was curious about with you as an editor. So I had met somebody from the main monitor on our tour, and he was telling me about how they have a weekly newsletter where he has a little bit more room for some narrative in whatever he writes. So he's able to write for each person, add a little bit more analysis into things, and I was just like, it's curious, you know, like, could this be incorporated more into, like, mainstream media and daily news models? And so, I don't know, what do you think as an editor, like, is there space for that?
I mean, what would it look like? Like, what would an idea be?
We were just talking, we were walking through this forest, and he was, like, we're both, like, really stricken by just, honestly, the surroundings, like, that we were looking at, just, like, all this different moss, bright red, trunks, and so he was like, oh, I could, like, totally write something really beautiful about this beautiful landscape and whatever I decide to send out in the newsletter. And so I think, you know, like, shifting paradigms for, like, what makes, like, good journalism, that kind of thing, is, like, well, if we leave more room for that, I guess, like, elevation of just nature in our writing, like what impact that can have on the points we're making, but also it's like, well, the audience, is there a fear of like audience trust, is that real?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
I don't know.
So, like, it could be an article like A Walk in the Woods.
Yeah, like
just
a walk
sort
in
of
the
a
woods.
Description of the walk in the woods and the interaction with the moss and the rain and the ferns and whatever, almost like froze.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would not make the cut by traditional standards at all. But I was thinking, as an example of a story that did this well, was the New York Times one about Flocko the Owl. Did you follow the New York Owl and Fannie Mae Loft? And a very, very sad outcome, ultimately.
Yeah.
But, and it kind of anthropomorphized the owl to an extent, but it was still, like, about this character of this owl. People loved those stories. It was, like, basically a viral story. Everyone was, like, rooting for Flocko the Owl. Because there was that anthropomorphization, because he was like, he escaped the zoo and he was like, making it. But then ultimately it illustrated the urban-wild interface, because he ended up dying because he ate rat poison and then ran into a wire, probably because he was tripping out on rat poison. And I thought that was an interesting example. It was still using, like, kind of humanizing, making him human in order to tell the story, but it was a non-human story in a very traditional news outlet that people were very interested in, that illustrated bigger issues in our society. So I think more stuff like that.
Do you see environmental journalism or journalism going more towards that in the future?
I mean, I think as long as they're positive stories, right? Like, everybody wants positive stories. If it makes people more hopeful, it makes them feel more connected with it.
the world around them. I mean, people really love, like, super hyper-local stories. Like, the pieces that did the best for me at WWE were, is it safe to swim in the bayou? It's a bayou that's, like, very, very, very public space in mid-city. So everybody knows it's a bayou. But it's like nasty. You, like, walk along your hot rocket, have a picnic along it, but the water is, like, warm and kind of nasty. So it was answering this question about how safe it was. And people love that story. They're really interested in it. It's hyper-local. They have a relationship with this water body. They read that story. Another one was about a rookery of a plant here in this one neighborhood. It's kind of an iconic neighborhood, and it's like a lot-long rookery where all these night herons are nesting around. And I just went there with a wildlife biologist, and we talked about it, and he explained to me what was happening. And the whole story was just about what's up with this rookery on this bloody avenue. People love that story because they have a relationship with that place, and it was answering their question. So I feel like that's a good way to get into it.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, everyone.
Great to chat.
So could everyone please take their seats? Rico is going to give us his introduction now.
Oh, yeah. We're having so much fun. Rico, are you there still? He might be taking a coffee break. Nobody warned him.
Rico. There he is.
Hello?
Great.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Rico, can you please give us your introduction?
Sure. So I'm just going to kind of read a couple things the others have written. So again, I'm just going to really briefly just go through this and not try to give too much context, but just read some things that others have written that I think is valuable. Okay, so this is again from Carmen Gonzalez. The planet's wealthiest inhabitants, the global north, plundered nature and exploited vast swaths of the world's population through colonialism, genocide, slavery, race, discrimination, the unpaid domestic labor of women, and the post-colonial domination and immiseration of the states and peoples of the global south. So that's a story that happened all over the globe. It's in everybody's beat. It's at the origins of every single environmental story we tell. It is that, in my opinion. And then I'm going to read this from Eduardo Galeano. He's someone who's been very influential in my thinking about.
Sorry, one second.
Rico, you got to stay close to your computer so we can hear you, and be careful with moving the papers.
And could you just restate what you just said about that being the root of all of our environmental stories?
Yeah, I do think it's the root of all of our environmental stories. I think that all of our environmental stories are rooted in this crisis of based in colonialism and its modern-day manifestations. I think that the IPCC not long ago recognized that colonialism is one of the foundations of the climate crisis. Okay, so anyway, so I'm going to just read something too. This is written by Eduardo Galeano. He says, I have been writing Memory of Fire for a long time, and the more I wrote, the more I entered into the stories I was telling. I was already having trouble distinguishing past from present. What had happened was happening all around me, and writing was my way of striking out and embracing. However, history books supposedly are not subjective. I mentioned this to Jose Coronel Urteco in this book I'm writing. However you look at it, backwards or forwards, in the light or against it, my loves and quarrels can be seen at a single glance. And on the banks of the San Juan River, the old poet told me, there is no reason to pay attention to the fanatics of objectivity. Don't worry, he said to me. That's how it should be. Those who make objectivity a religion are liars. They are scared of human pain. They don't want to be objective. It's a lie. They want to be objects so as not to suffer. Why does one write, if not to put one's pieces together? From the moment we enter school or church, education chops us into pieces. It teaches us to divorce soul from body and mind from heart. The fishermen of the Colombian coast must be learned doctors of ethics and morality, for they invented the word sente pensante, feeling thinking, to define language that speaks the truth. And so I'm going to go back to a story I wrote, one of my earlier stories for the Boulder Weekly in Colorado. And I was interviewing a person named Ava Hamilton, a Arapaho tribal member. And it kind of goes back to that question I asked, you know, how many people think water is alive or the earth is alive? And so this question I have is, how do we report on and frame stories about people who believe that. And so I'm just going to read something that she wrote from this story. She says she totally agrees with the anti-sentiment that they don't know that the Earth's alive. I saw something recently that said water has memory. And I thought, wait, they don't know what? They don't know that water's alive? How scientists in their research believe that there is only proof that there is, that's a misstatement. They're not only the scientists. It's not only the proof. Who made them the authority? She didn't. I didn't. The scientists need education about knowing and respecting. So basically, the point being that for her, it's so obvious and straightforward that the Earth is alive, that water's alive. She mentioned this Japanese scientist, Masaru Emoto, who studied water crystals, and they formed and were completely and wholly when people were singing songs around them or offering kind prayers to them. So I guess one of the critical things is, I think, that about TEK, I don't really want to say this is what TEK is. Okay. Because there are real experts in the world and indigenous people in the world who are very well aware and expert in that, have been practicing what we now call traditional ecological knowledge by another name, by just simply it was completely embedded in their culture since time immemorial and allowed lots of people to live in harmony with the environment and not to destroy it as Western civilization has done. This goes back to the ideological origins. You know, if you're looking for a kind of a theoretical framework to approach these stories from, I think it has a lot to do with understanding the ideological origins of the hegemonic narratives that we so often propagate and are asked to propagate or forced to propagate in our stories, and to interrogate those origins and think of and feature and center and amplify other origins and other present ideologies that in fact are sustainable, largely indigenous and otherwise, and those that kind of trend toward that space. So I think as reporters, one of the really important things that we need to learn how to do is learn how to be open-minded. When we talk to maybe an indigenous person that says water's alive, just like you might say, I have this much money in my bank account, right? Maybe with even more certainty and a different kind of certainty, a different kind of value. How do you frame that? How do you interview that person and talk to them? If in your heart, going back to this idea of feeling and thinking, sente pensante, of Eduardo Galeano, you don't really believe it, you know? How do you report on these things? It makes me really wonder if so many of the reporters that exist today, so many of the publications that exist today aren't really capable of doing the kind of journalism that needs to be done. And I think that a lot of us need to start our own publications. Because I think that a lot of times it's like we get shoehorned into these boxes, into these arbitrary boundaries, which are really just meant to reify power structures. And those in and of themselves, that formal enactment of power is a concomitant factor in this unsustainable ideology that's driving the destruction of the planet and humanity. So, how do you write about it? I think being open-minded, open-hearted. The heart and the mind are connected. I'll say that. I don't think that's, I'm not, well, whatever, I'll say that. So when you're reporting on stories, if say you take a stretch and you get a story landed about an indigenous community who has a totally different perspective on an issue that may be directly contradictory to powerful economic forces that maybe even are fundamentally responsible for your paycheck, to really like give them their say, you know, let them speak as you know they mean to speak. So as far as specific ideas or specific stories, I mean, Tegan was very kind in inviting me and mentioning a story with Yes Magazine on the Confederated Tribes of the Colville. And they, like many Native American tribes or indigenous people in the Western Hemisphere and across the globe, really, primarily had the river that they relied upon, the Columbia River, was dammed. But before that, diseases that for which they and native wildlife that they relied upon had came to their lands, they were essentially unable to withstand that. And so all these systems and all these animals, these species, were essentially destroyed by settler colonialism in various iterations. And they're slowly bringing them back, the animals back. But unlike a lot of other agencies, they're able to bring back animals quicker, right? They don't have the same constraints, or they're not as hesitant to bring back species. And it's going quite well, right? They're rewilding this term. They're just restoring. It's restoring what was there before. And the title of the story, Welcoming Relatives Home, Relatives. And so when I said, is water alive? Is earth alive? Are animals sentient relatives? That's pretty common. Is recognizing that animals, wild animals, are sentient relatives and coexist in this this ecosystem that functions wholly on its own. It really doesn't need our intervention. It needs our, that's the point here. This story was that they're saying, like, hey, we're just going to bring them back and let them do what they do because they know what their role is. That's inherent in them. They know what their role is. So I think for us, and maybe what's most useful for us, and maybe I'm preaching to the choir here, but I think it's important that we write stories about Indigenous people and tell their story in ways that really communicates what they really believe and think, even if we don't understand it, and especially when we don't understand it, and not to subjugate their ideologies in our reporting formally or explicitly, but to amplify it, to really offer it as if it was a viable, realistic way of thinking, because I don't know if I'm the only one who thinks this, but this idea that we're the masters of the universe and the masters of the earth, and who is we when we say we, is not only arrogant, but it's wrong. It's obviously wrong. You can't fix a problem using the same ideology that caused it. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Rico. I think, that other than human awareness and respect, before I say that, just science, Western science is inherently reductionist, right? Like, you're trying to eliminate all the variables so you can come to that, sure conclusion, whereas traditional ecological knowledge is systems theory, right? It's systems-based. It's looking at all the relationships among the entities and that close relationship. And for the popular science story I referenced earlier, I interviewed a Hopi farmer who also has a PhD in ecology, Michael Katwa Johnson. And he told me, when you have 3,000 years of replication, that's a science. And I think that respect for other than human beings, that turning away from human supremacy, which is what guides our dominant culture. There's the rights of nature movement, which I just want to mention briefly that you may be familiar with, rivers getting rights, nature getting rights at a national level, like in Ecuador. And that's it's a growing movement, and it's a way to bring these ideas kind of into the mainstream, and people argue about the pros and cons of that, right? Because these entities do have an inherent right to exist. But I can't help but wonder, like 100 years ago, women barely had rights in the United States. Even when I was born, like, a woman couldn't open a bank account without a man signing on, you know. And I wonder if we're going to turn in like 50 or 100 years and think it was crazy that nature didn't have rights. At this point, I would like to open it up to everybody, the other panelists and the audience, to talk about any of the ideas that we've been discussing. And we'll do that through the end of the session at 11:15.
Hi, and thanks everybody for a really fantastic panel. Huge amount to think about here.
Can you tell us who you are?
I'm Jay Owens from the London Review of Books, and last year I published a book, Dust, the Modern World in a Trillion Particles. The thing I'd like to kind of say here is that America isn't the world, and to push back a little bit on the idea that these ideas are extremely fringe, very strange, must be a little concerned. You know, Kate Raworth of Donut Economics is a professor at the University of Oxford. You were mentioning other scholars at the LSE. These are extremely mainstream institutions. Donut Economics is the state policy of the city of Amsterdam. You know, this is not like weird fringe Amsterdam. This is the home of capitalism and high-frequency trading Amsterdam. Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass is a massive bestseller. Robert McFarlane, the UK's by far the biggest nature writer, his new book coming out is on Are Rivers Alive and the Rights of Rivers and all of these sorts of movements. So, with precedents like those, you really can say that these stories are not necessarily so out there. And, you know, I really respect how hard it is to put them into local news reporting. But maybe with some examples like this, you can, and also pitch the Guardian. There are ways to tell these stories, and I do think there is much, much more appetite for them than, you know, don't hold yourselves back. Do think you can say these things. I put a lot of Indigenous reporting into my book and have not had any negativity on that. I had good reviews in the right-wing UK press, which is wild, but it shows it's possible, right? So that is not a question. But
no, thank you. Thank you. Rico, are you able to hear audience?
Yeah, Joy, that was awesome. Thanks so much for your comment. And your, really glad that you're here, and glad to hear that things are, I think, the challenge, I think we didn't really talk about the context so much, but I think realistically we're talking about the context of American environmental journalism publications. But I would say too, like yesterday in a luncheon that I was virtually attending to, there was a reporter from the UK who was talking about the issues that she was experiencing from a diversity, equity, and inclusion perspective in her publication, that there's, even if some of these different ideas are more accepted, that there's still a real... She was saying that publications in the UK are behind on the conversations in the newsrooms and publications of journalism at large about diversity, equity, inclusion. So that's heartening to hear on one hand, but I wonder if you have thoughts on that too.
On the DEI side, I think the answer is probably broadly yes. I've never worked in a large newsroom, so I can't speak on the specifics of that. But, I get the impression the US conversation is generally farther ahead on that side. So, yes, not trying to claim the UK as a paradigm of virtue here by any extent. But, look to sort of wider global examples maybe for pitches and just help say that these things are sort of, you know, when you're trying to persuade an editor that these things matter, I think there are good examples.
I think Braiding Sweetgrass is a great example because it's like basically a viral book. And if you all have read it, it's like a slow read, a slow, thoughtful read. People are hungry for this kind of writing right now, I think.
Hi, I'm Kayla. I'm with the Washington Informer, which is a small, pretty local paper in covering D.C. and Maryland's black communities. It's a member of the Black Press. And I guess I wanted to sort of just bring up the idea that we don't have to tackle this huge paradigm shift in like one fell swoop of an article. And while I've been at The Informer, I've kind of maybe because it is a member of the black press and not doesn't feel the same some of the same pressures to follow mainstream media's kind of parameters all the time. I've had the opportunity to cover sort of profiles, basically, of people doing urban gardening, people doing things they talk about, communities of care, people who are pushing back on these economic ideas in their own small ways. And instead of trying to think like, well, how do I connect this to the poly crisis? I just write about these people and what they're doing, and I don't frame it as like, this is fringe and radical. And I also focus on insight. What could other people learn from this that they might apply in their own lives and their own interpersonal relations versus scalability, which I think is sometimes what people like want to see. Oh, how could we do this everywhere? But you don't have to do it everywhere. We just have to do it somewhere. So I just think if we can talk more about, and any of the panelists too, the ways in which we could challenge these paradigms, talk about the poly crisis, but in little chunks that I could do tomorrow instead of like, how do I pitch an editor on this huge, huge thing?
Thank you for go ahead, Rico.
Yeah, I was just going to really briefly respond. This last article that article in Yes Magazine, there's, you know, there's ways you can, there are small ways you can do this stuff in terms of the subtlety of language. I think that I refer, here's an interesting thing, because language is always a representative of thought and perception. And so I was writing about the Columbia River, which was dammed severally, but one of the dams created, quote unquote, Franklin Delano Roosevelt Lake, right? Lake. So what's wrong with that? That's not accurate. It's not a lake. It's a reservoir. So I called, I have no idea what those balloons just came out there. Anyway, that was really weird. The cat. But in subtle ways too. And I think you're right. Your profiling is really important because people care about people, no matter who they are, where they come from. If they believe water is alive, if they believe the earth is alive, if they believe that animals have, you know, equal rights on some level, there's a different way that relationship happens there. They still have families and struggles and kids and parents, and that's showing their life while showing a different worldview is a formal enactment in the article itself that can help people understand what they're actually saying and feeling.
Yeah, thank you for raising the issue of language. Just one response to what you said about, you know, we don't have to do it everywhere. The slow water approaches in my book are very specific to place, right? Every place has unique geology, ecology, and human culture. And so, yeah, the solution has to work within that, like slow food. But they're also replicable and scalable. Like every little bit helps, and cumulatively it helps more. And then with regard to language, one thing that I try to do in my stories is instead of referring to animals, for example, as it, the pronoun it, you know, I try to make it they, or, you know, a pronoun like that. And sometimes editors allow it and sometimes they don't. But I feel like that's just a small but kind of big thing, where we are separating ourselves and making it less than human and less important.
I really love that idea, Erica.
Thanks, everybody. I'm Eric with Manga Bay. One of the things I do there is edit opinion pieces. And so pinging off of the language and the traditional knowledge ideas we're having a good discussion about, I wanted to share just this idea that I'm working on right now for a new piece by an indigenous scholar who is who is having trouble with the rights of nature idea, which is very interesting to me because he's saying, you know, in Osage we don't have a word for rights and we don't have a word for nature. And he understands the importance of the legal instrument for conservation, and he's very much aligned with the idea that we need to conserve what we have, but you know, rights is maybe it's more like relationship, or it's more like, or actually, he said, you know, rights is more like relationship, and nature is more like some other word he had for a relationship. Anyway, it was like, is he's coming at it from an indigenous scholarship perspective, and he's like wrestling with, you know, is this Western instrument applicable to what, you know, the biggest question is? And I think it's an interesting pressure point, because from a Western perspective, it's very powerful, and we're seeing it do really interesting things in the world. But to put the biggest lens on top of it, from the indigenous perspective, I was wondering if the panel had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, thanks, Eric, for coming and for offering that and asking that question. I think that we just have to be careful not to become dogmatic about anything as journalists, and always keep an open mind and sort of lean into the complexity, as opposed to, again, Escape from Freedom, as Eric Frum would have, which is a really good book for those of you who haven't read it. But I'm also reminded, you know, to mention a British writer, old one, John Keats. And I don't know if Joy, you remember this quote, this idea of negative capability from John Keats's letters. He says, negative capability is when one is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any reaching after fact and reason. So this idea of like delimiting context, and getting and leaning into the complexity, reporting more fully on the complexity, to the point earlier about not having one giant chunk and just fail swoop, but like in different pieces, articulating different dimensions of the complexity of the context that we're in, I think is a good way to get at that. And I think, yeah, that's a good point about TEK not really being necessarily a term that's used by some communities, but they're kind of shoehorned into. And I think we have to be careful as journalists not to, you know, we have to be careful to remain centering Indigenous people and their perspectives, as opposed to assuming that we know what they're talking about, and again, frame that complexity in your story. I think that'd be really fascinating, and I would say very innovative.
Hi. Hello. Hi there, I'm Bill Kavirik. I'm a historian and a journalist and an academic. Sorry, I had a little bit of... and I just want to point out that, you know, there have been plenty of people working in the area of alternative economic systems for a long time, and I would hate for people to go away from this conversation thinking that it's all brand new. And I just want to mention E.F. Schumacher, Economics as If People Mattered, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken with Natural Capitalism, Raoul Prebisch, Dependency Theory, which has to do with the declining terms of trade in the global south and why that happens. So there's an enormous volume of economic and environmental theory, and it's really important to approach it and not necessarily to try to shoehorn it into all the stories, but to use it as a guide in the same way this really brilliant idea of the nine barriers is a very useful framework to be thinking about that. So there's economic systems approaches that are not, you know, pure exploitative capitalism that I think are useful to recall, that those are out there as well, and they've been there for a while. You know, this is something that came along in the, and you're probably, Tegan, aware of all of these. You've heard.
Yeah, E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful, for example. I think it's important for us as journalists to read those books and understand that there are alternative economic models that we could be upholding and elevating in our reporting. And I think that was more of the point that I was trying to make. But also, I am no expert, and I am glad that there are folks here who know more about it than I do.
Do you want to say something?
Well, I did want to put in a plug. If you're finding you can't do stories on some of these difficult topics or difficult to get placed, I mean, for years, I was a freelancer for like 20 years before I got an editor's job. And some of these stories I had a notebook just full of crazy ideas that I couldn't place. And I just would keep working on them and keep working on them and keep trying to place them, because we're dealing with a dominant paradigm that's very resistant to change. And so finding an angle, I mean, we just did a story on toilet paper. And, you know, it sounds goofy. We did a story on cocaine. We did a story on, but we did it on, and told the story of the supply chain. And so what that story did for me, the toilet paper story, is it really connected me to deforestation in, you know, South America and in Indonesia and where toilet paper comes from, Canadian boreal forests.
Old growth.
And it just, and so every time I reach for the roll now, I'm thinking about where it came from and thinking outside the box, outside this, the box we live in and the box of the thing, all this stuff that we're surrounded by. And then thinking around the traditional and indigenous knowledge. I mean, where I lived in New Jersey, there was virtually no indigenous people. There were a few very scant remnants of the Lenape, the tribes who had lived there. But I found traditional knowledge all over the place. A woman on a Christmas tree farm. She was like in her late 80s, and I just happened to be in conversation with her about, oh, you know, you've really been here a long time. She was tending trees since she was like 8 years old. And I said, so what's gone missing? And, oh, my God, what a story. I mean, something like 80 or 90 species locally that she could name, flowers and herbs and things that, and small amphibians and frogs. Anyway, those stories are everywhere, these outside the box, and they might be your next door neighbor. They might be somebody at the local store. I mean, there's people doing some pretty wonderful stuff in our communities, and very tight focused. They're not those big planetary boundary stories. Every story can't save the world, but can save a small piece of it.
And I think that kind of close attention to the land is really, you know, opens up that those kinds of systems and connections. When I went around the world reporting my book, I met many different kinds of people who were cultivating that in their communities and in their relationship with the land, like not just indigenous peoples, but farmers and urban landscape architects. And, you know, that I feel like that close attention and respect is available to all of us, and certainly is also present in a lot of different sources.
Kayla, you had asked me an interesting question about how to do stories like this in your region. I forgot, where are you from? Oh, in Michigan. So we were kind of like workshopping different story ideas, and this is not specifically about economics, but about people's relationship with the land in their own communities. And what came to mind was a couple stories I did in New Orleans at WWNO. Hi, Eva. A couple of years ago. One was about whether or not you could swim in this bayou. So it's this human relationship with this place, right? This bayou is, everybody knows the bayou, go for walks there, have picnics there, whatever, but it like looks pretty nasty. And so the story was, can I swim in the bayou? So there was no economic frame. It wasn't really news, but people loved that story. They really wanted to know because they had a relationship with that place. Another was about a rookery, like a nesting grounds for night herons. People know it's there. They drive down the streets, this beautiful, famous streets, Esplanade. Have you seen the rookery of all the night herons with the big nests? And so it was like, what's up with the night herons on Esplanade Avenue? And everyone loved that story. I got so much good listener feedback. And we just like walked around with like a bird guy who like explained to me what night herons, like what their habits were and how the sort of urban human interface might affect their habitat in this space. So also not like a news story. I mean, the herons were nesting at the time, but there was no economic value per se. It wasn't impacting people. There weren't politicians involved, but people responded to that story really well because they had a relationship with that place. So I think stories that kind of elevate our relationship with the natural world, whether that's urban or otherwise, can be a really interesting way to like elevate some of these things.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And that was a key way that I pulled readers into my book, is because, you know, most people are attached to their place and they care for their place and they have curiosity about their place. And so the slow water projects that I document in my book, they all start with some form of historical ecology. So when asking, like, what does water want? What water wants is some semblance of, like, what it did before we significantly subverted it. And so, you know, the reason why housing development built on a wetland is the first to flood is because it's still a wetland and, you know, water always wins. And so that kind of, you know, well, what was here before we were here and how did it work and what remnants are still there and where, oh look, you know, here's the creek in my basement, you know, when the spring rains come. And I think those kinds of, like place-based connections and intrigues are a good way in.
Does anyone have any stories they're working on right now, or they want to workshop, or did someone have their hand up that I missed?
Sharon had her hand up, and then in the front over here, Tegan after.
Mine isn't a story, it's just a comment. You know, I think all of this comes back to storytelling. You know, whether the land is the character, or whether it's an animal, or whether it's a researcher, you know, unless we can engage hearts and minds, there's way too much distraction out there, and people aren't going to read what we do. So I feel like every time I approach a story, I try to think storytelling first.
Thank you.
I think that's really, really a good point. I was thinking about this. I was out for a little walk yesterday by the ocean where I live, and I was thinking about that, how storytelling is this fundamental human thing. It's in language and reading is such a powerful way to make meaning. And storytelling is at its base, maybe, you know, all this talk recently about like trauma, et cetera, and like, well, the fight or flight response. I say, you know, if there's a saber-toothed tiger, you got to run away. But storytelling is has the same very deep root in the sense that some of these stories that were told amongst all of our ancestors at one point in time or various points in time were meant to be useful, right? They're useful. So if a story is useful and is told in a way that's tailored to the audience so that they can understand it, so that they can really take it in. And so I think the challenge for us in lots of ways is how to tell these stories in light of the new media forms, social media, the short attention span. How do you get that going? But to Tegan's point about, you know, Braiding Suitcase, or the fact that it's a bestseller, that is it's a slow moving book and a deep meditative book. So I would say that we should still hold out hope that people read and they care about things that are told in a way that's quiet and slow and deep.
Thank you for that, Rico. I think a story that did this really well was about Flacco the owl. Did you guys see the New York Times story? It was like a viral story. It was just about an owl. Now, the owl was a little anthropomorphized, I would argue. But it was viral. Like, everybody was invested in this owl that escaped the zoo, succeeding in New York City. Of course, it came to a very, very devastating end. But ultimately, like, illustrated the human, like, the urban-wild interface because of how the poor owl died. But I mean, that was just a story about one owl, and we were all very excited to read it. Was there a question in the front? Yeah.
I've been curious about the concept or role of speculative reporting. I mean, I think maybe my favorite story I've ever written was I asked the question of, like, what would it look like and how would we do it if we wanted to bring beavers back to New York City in the current New York City? And recently I've been toying around with this idea of, like, pitching a story around, okay, we like trees in the city. How dense could we possibly make the urban canopy? I'm curious to know what you guys think. Like, can speculative reporting tell some of these stories, look at these things in an interesting way? And if so, how to pitch those, how to place those, how to have editors be interested in these kinds of, like, theoretical ideas?
Sounds like a good question for the editors on the panel to answer.
Yeah, I love that idea. It kind of comes back to what I said earlier about the Mississippi River. Like, what does it want? If someone pitched me a story on what does the river want, I think I would take that, like a speculative story about if we did let the river run its course and switch over to the Atchafalaya and abandon New Orleans and it all dried up, what would that look like? What would happen if we didn't have the port industry there? Maybe they would be fine. Maybe there would be less flooding because there'd be less water. I'd actually be really interested in a story like that. I'm interested in other folks' perspectives on this, too.
I certainly would be interested because, you know, a lot of, like probably everybody's day, it's a lot of the day is drudgery. And then when a pitch like that comes in, it's like, oh, the light goes on and I suddenly am alert and awake. And suddenly I'm thinking out of the box with you and we've made a connection and there's a high probability we'll have a conversation and do a story. I mean, that's another thing about make the connection with the editor. Make the editor care about your story. And some of the, you know, I think these, giving voice to whatever doesn't have voice is a really cool thing to do. And that's kind of what that story does, giving a voice to trees. You know, what if they got some rights and got to be where they were? When they came back, and what would that look like? And you can talk to all kinds of people to find out, from, you know, arborists to scientists to, you know, people walking through Central Park. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you could frame it that would be really fun and interesting. I think you'd get, I think you'd sell the story, and I think you'd get readers, too.
I speak for the trees, said the Lorax.
Yeah.
But I do think, like, those other than human viewpoints, you know, there's a lot of focus now on marginalized voices, which is so important and still not nearly enough. But I'd like to encourage people to think of those other than human marginalized voices as well.
Thank you all for this wonderful panel. It has brought a lot to mind and has given a lot to think.
What's your name?
Think about. Yes, of course. My name is Michaela Thornton, and I am a master's candidate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, near where you are. So I have a bit of a nebulous question that I've been kind of thinking about how to phrase here, which is how to bring all of these stories home to the reader who is just trying to keep the lights on, to the reader who is stuck within the bounds of racial capitalism, to the reader who is just trying to stay alive and get through the day to day and is quite worried about climate change and all of these planetary boundaries, but is just trying to get to work in the morning. These are all wonderful stories to tell, but just in a kind of nebulous way, how do we bring these stories home to that reader?
Thank you for that question. In my stories, I always try to answer that question, and often it is, you know, we have this history of humans as most important and prioritizing humans, and specifically, you know, specific humans, white, wealthier humans. But these natural systems that support us, you know, the things that we're doing are undermining them. And so caring for them can be a way to reduce flooding in your house. You know, caring for them can be a way to not have your neighborhood be so hot during a heat wave. So I think, you know, making that connection explicit can be a way to do that.
I would say, too, one thing that's interesting, another thing that SUJ is doing that I'm sort of tangentially connected to, is to try to support local independent news outlets, online news outlets. And some of the feedback, we had a workshop last year in Boise, and there's no one going this conference, I think. But a lot of the feedback we got is like, you know, there's a lot of reader feedback going on in these small community-oriented papers. They're very, very plugged into what their readers need, and they design their reporting and their tools specifically to what their readers need. So it may not be necessarily what we think they need, but there's a lot of gathering feedback, asking them what would be useful to you. And so I think I would say that.
Yeah, I think this topic kind of segues into a bigger topic on engagement that a lot of us are exploring right now, and ways to source story ideas or topics from our communities and then meet them where they're at. I believe Southerly, the Southern nonprofit news outlet that is now defunct, did some sort of like pamphleting where they, I don't know if it was about flooding or home insurance, but they worked with the community, did some stories, but then actually created pamphlets and went and handed those out to community members to meet them where they were at and bring the information to them rather than assuming that they were going to go online and read their story about it there. Other thoughts? Anybody who hasn't spoken yet? Did you get a chance?
Hi, I'm Dan Fagan. I write and teach. So in my current research, I've been thinking a lot about this concept of old concept, but tricky one, of payments for environmental services and, you know, sort of applying a framework of capitalism to, you know, these benefits that we know are so incredibly important. But it feels both limiting and, to use your term, Erica, you know, reductionist to sort of, okay, we're going to attach a specific monetary value to it. On the other hand, it also feels inescapable somehow. So I'm wondering if anybody in the panel or really anybody in the crowd has thoughts about how we should be thinking about attaching monetary value to benefits that are not measurable in the conventional sense, and whether we're really helping in the long run by doing that.
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's something I've written about a fair bit, including in my book. There's a section on it, and I think, you know, the dominant economic system, there's so many externalities, of course, right? Like, we're not counting, when we build that levee to protect that one community, we're not counting against it the damage that it causes to the neighboring community. We're not counting against it the flood absorption lost, or the water supply lost, or the carbon storage lost, or the habitat for salmon lost. And, you know, who pays for that is usually the environment and marginalized communities. You know, I think of like Chevron and the Amazon dumping all of their pollution into the water that indigenous people, you know, got all of their food and water from, a case that's been going on for many decades. So I think the movement for ecosystem services and accounting for them, it is a way, kind of like rights of nature, to bring that into the dominant economic frame. So the sources I talk to, a lot of them feel like it's important to do that. And, you know, the Biden administration has now codified quantifying ecosystem benefits. The UN has a program that some tens of nations, not a lot, have signed up for, started doing that accounting. You know, how that's used is uncertain. The countervailing argument is that when you commodify something, that's different from its fundamental right to exist. And so the choice to potentially exploit it to extinction or to economic extinction becomes a market-based choice, which is, they argue, unethical. And I think that's a really important thing to think about. So I don't know what the answer is. I think like some movement toward it is probably necessary, but with maybe, you know, more acceptance of alternative worldviews that value in inherent rights. You know, like a lot of the people I met in reporting my book, they don't consider water to be a commodity or a threat. They consider it to be a relative or a friend. And that kind of inherent in that worldview is more systems thinking, you know, about the relationships. So half of
I would
one,
say,
six
I'm gonna drop
right.
in. I think that's really helpful, Eric. That's really a good point. And I think this question about accounting for environmental services or providing monetary benefit for these things and TEK and having a monetary value, I think that, yeah, it's really important to report on it, obviously, and tell stories about it. But I think to Eric's question, Eric Hoffner just now, about, you know, the scholar thinking about, the indigenous scholar thinking about, well, there's not really a word in our language for TEK or these sort of concepts. I think that's important to think about language and how the English language functions too. And again, going back to origins and ideological origins, because I think probably in some indigenous languages, there are different structures that form meaning, the perception of reality differently. For example, I believe there are some languages that something can't exist out of context, for example. Like, you can't just say a tree. That has no meaning whatsoever. You can't just say a river has no meaning whatsoever. You have to put it in its proper context. You have to say a tree on a hill in spring. And, like, the more description and context you give it, the more meaningful it becomes. So I think that, like, telling the story about the importance of the rights of nature, legal movement, et cetera, while also saying, but there are also questions. So as opposed to this thought, thinking of, you know, one or the other, it's like both and, right? Both can exist at the same time. And I think we're, again, this sort of singular thinking, there's this concept called white supremacy culture that is articulated in a way that talks a lot about this. The board of directors for SEJ took workshops from a consultant that kind of introduced us to this concept. But it's important to recognize there's diversity of different ideas, and how do we, in our reporting, how do we convey the diversity of perspectives in a way that's not like both sidesism, but also conveys the importance. And I don't have an answer, but I think it's important to try your own way.
Hi, I'm Brian Check with the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. And going back to Dan Fagan's question, I think there's another problem in addition to what Erica mentioned with the monetizing approach to trying to conserve natural capital and ecosystem services. It's kind of a technical problem, and I don't know how easy it would be to get it into environmental journalism, but you know, money doesn't come out of heaven. You know, it's not manna from heaven. Money is generated at the trophic base of the economy, the agricultural and extractive surplus that frees the hands for the division of labor and warrants a money supply and a flow of money. So if you're going to introduce a new anything that's going to take payment, introduce that, foist that into an otherwise more or less free market, right? Which we know it's not that free. But you know what I mean? You're foisting something that previously hadn't had to been paid for. Now you have to generate more money, all else equal, to accommodate that new entry into the marketplace. So, you know, we call that the trophic theory of money at CASI. And I think there are ways to put it in pretty basic terms for environmental journalism, but good luck with it, too.
That's a good point. I have seen some success. Like, for example, in my book, I went to Peru, and they have a massive water scarcity problem as the glaciers are melting and their population is increasing. And they have nationwide laws that require water utilities to invest in upstream catchments, in indigenous practices for slowing water on the land, and in these rare high-altitude wetlands called bofedales. And so, and I saw something similar in Kenya, that connection of mountaintop water supply and downstream water users through some kind of financial instrument. And, you know, it's not a perfect system, but it does make people more aware of where their water comes from and how you need to take care of the watershed. I think we have time for one last question, and I just want to thank all of my co-panelists and everybody in the audience for a really, really great discussion. I really enjoyed it. Do we have a last question?
This has been so fun and comment? So lovely, and I feel like I have lots of new ideas, which is why I wanted to do this, so I'm excited.
Hi, thanks for this. I'm Teresa Brain from the New York Daily News. And before that, I was at Indian Country Today Media Network. I was the environment editor. So I got a whole perspective, you know, on what is science, what do we think of as science. And I don't know, I had a few thoughts that hopefully people can build on. First of all, we talk about growth, but we always unquestionably accept that it's about material growth and economic growth, and we conflate profit with prosperity. Because profit just talks about money, prosperity is includes well-being in the balance sheet and life. So these are ways I try to challenge myself to think outside the box. The other thing is what gets left out. You know, that really occurred to me with the Me Too movement. It's like all these people who couldn't contribute to the arts, like what do we lose by, you know, and that applies to pretty much everything that gets closed out by the isms. And if any of you have thoughts on expounding on that, it would be great.
Any last thoughts, Rico or Glenn? Either on that or anything else?
Yeah, I'll just talk about the idea of growth, endless growth. And I mean, I think there's lots of different ways to grow. And I think there are people who are growing in different ways. And I think reporting that doesn't directly frame itself in the dominant paradigm in and of itself is going to have an impact on the unsustainable ideologies that have driven the Anthropocene, I think. But thank you so much to everybody for coming, my fellow panelists. You guys are wonderful and brilliant, and I wish I was there, but
we wish you were here
hopefully
too.
Next year. All right.
Glenn, do you have any last thoughts?
I just would say, you know, anything that helps you to wake up and to wake up your readers to where we're at this present moment, that's a good story. Could be a good story. And keep pitching.
Dan, question what we decide news is. Maybe it doesn't have to be all those parameters that we were taught in journalism school. Maybe there are other ways to tell stories. And other experts who aren't old white guys.
Thank you all so much for coming. Really
appreciate
it.
Thank you.